Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkberg. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred. Hey. Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, we recorded yesterday. We're recording today. We're on a roll here. hey, I got a topic for you. It came up to me this morning.
Okay.
And it was a question of, you know, there's all the, like, there's the change within, at the time of recording this, there's restrictions on oil transport through the Strait of Hormuz. There's uncertainty in political realms. There's all right. this different stuff going on, you know, and there's inflation profiles. And so this person was in a, is in a company that's saying, you know, we're scrambling because we use stuff that comes through there and we can't get it. And it's, you know, impacting our supply chain and everybody's focused on that. And nobody wants to look for a new job and there's nobody's hiring. And it was like, and I get like 800 emails a day. How do I keep reliability? How do I keep reliability, the work to create a reliable product, important? How do I compete with all of this noise that's going on? And I thought, I never thought of it that way. For
yeah,
me, reliability is always important.
Yeah, it's right. It's again, reliability is sometimes an afterthought, and in many companies a low priority in the development stage, and that's one of the big problems is. It's always been, you know, because many times you can design a product and without halt or HASS or even testing it, if you follow some good design rules, it comes out pretty good. It comes out pretty reliable.
You know, you get lucky sometimes.
You get lucky. Yeah. I mean, but not, and, you know, companies that have experience in developing hardware don't always come up with a latent defect in their products and certainly learn once they do and it's cost them. And that's when they, you know, really focus on maybe prevention. But many go a long time without failures. And so, you know, it's again, just like once you have a robust design, it is difficult to keep reliability important in the manufacturing because I don't know if you've developed HASS screens or, you know, and you know, there is a period of time that you shouldn't be still seeing defects. You should have weeded most of those out or the causes in manufacturing, which is really what you're doing in a HASS test is looking for flaws introduced during the manufacturing process, because through halt, you should have developed a robust design that had plenty of margin or certainly the margins available with standard materials. And you shouldn't be seeing, you know, so, but if you do keep running the HASS test when your product has kind of become matured and it's very low failure rate in the field, then, you know, you kind of, it is questionable whether it has a real significant added value or you're getting a good ROI.
Right. And I've heard that argument before, and I've seen where people say it was a long time ago when burn-in was considered the thing to do.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, and it was, oh, we're doing HASS. It's a little quicker and we always do it on everything all the time. I was like, why? You're not finding anything. You're burning all this electricity and time and delay, and you're not getting anything. And so, we always do it. I'm like, well, okay, if you got the money, you know, whatever floats your boat. But in this circumstance, I would, you know, if you're got a mature product, everything's going, and then all of a sudden you have to shift to a different supplier or a different manufacturing site or stuff like that, you know, bring that old numbers together, because that test will help you identify
exactly
what those changes have, where they've wreaked havoc. I wanted to work that phrase in here somewhere.
Havoc. Yes, introduce something that produces havoc in the field. Yes, yeah. It does.
Well, that might be a whole nother podcast, because I can see the title now. It's like, oh, it's the same form, fit, and function.
Yeah, exactly. But that's where going back, and you know, once you've established empirical margins, you've actually observed where the product strength limits are, and that's again a challenge to get people to get engineering to do that, because they all complain that it's way beyond it'll ever see that in its in use environment. But once you've established that in your development, and you had to have a supplier chain, then you would take that component, that material, power supply, whatever you have to do, whatever change you make, and put it into the product as it's established, or what to put that replacement in, and then evaluate it again and see if it has the same margins, the same voltage margin, the same thermal stress limits.
Yeah.
And if it does, it might even be better.
It might even be good. Yeah, you mean really good. I've rarely been surprised with that,
Yeah,
you spend 6 months picking the perfect power supply. You do all this vetting and testing and evaluation and design work. And then you got 2 days to find a new one.
Right.
Yeah, you might get a good one, but you might not. Yeah.
Well, and that could be why, one of the things that I always talked about is using stress tests to compare competing suppliers for the same component or device that you need, like a power supply, which is pretty common. And, of course, in PCs, the silver boxes was always, required, and there were several different suppliers to choose from. And so we put those through a test and, found the significant differences in the margins on each power supply. And, obviously.
So you would have a preferred one then, but.
Right.
But you were making so many of them, you still needed to be able to accommodate the other ones. And.
Right.
So but I'm thinking of, there's two parts to answer this question. One is when there is disruptions to your supply chain, or just cost pressures that you need to do cost cutting somewhere, and it might reduce use different components, and it's a difference in your supply chain. Is that almost always, and I have rare exceptions where those changes actually are benign or have no effect on the reliability performance. So what you just outlined is a great way to check that, to make sure that the changes are safe or are not going to harm the reliability.
Right.
The second part of that, though, is somebody says, well, we got to cut costs now. And it is a more difficult argument to say, well, if you save a nickel today and we pay 50 cents per unit that you put this in later, we're going to go bankrupt. If you save a few pennies today and none of your power supplies work in 3 months, we're still going to have to pay that number. But the argument I get back from folks is, well, I need to pay the bills today. And if you're in that dire of a strait and you can't look ahead 3 months or 6 months, then it's get your resume together, because they're going down the tubes. But it's also then find a good finance person or find another champion that says, this is, what's the old saying? Penny wise and pound foolish. I think it deals.
It's
British money. It only makes sense with their currency. But the idea is that you can save a couple nickels today, but you're going to be paying if you don't do it deliberately, such that those savings aren't going to cost you adverse responses later. But you also get, we got to save the money. We have to have a supplier to make this power supply work. And we don't have money to test it. And we don't have time to test it. And I'm like, it's a hard one to go over the top of, but you got to find somebody to help you say, we have to be in business next quarter too.
Right. And what is your supply inventory like, and how quickly you're going to have to change?
Well, some companies nowadays, it's like day to day. They don't
Oh,
have
yeah,
any
it's
supply
just
in-house.
In time. You know, that's what we learned, just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah, it's just a disaster waiting to happen is another phrase for it.
What was that, the Kaizen system or something? You'd have the bins,
have the parts show
flags.
Up just as and just as needed. That's it.
Yeah, just as needed. So, so they don't have a lot of inventory ready many times. But you know, as far as having to make changes, that's kind of something that all supplier, usually anybody that's manufacturing for more the same component or same system for more than 5 or 6 years is going to have to change some of the components during that time.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It should be an established practice of this is how we assess the risk and then we move forward. But if you're doing it the first time and you're under a time crunch or, you know, this global, you know, and we had practice during COVID, right? There were bunches of nothing was coming out of China for a while.
Right, right, right. Well, that is a challenge, though. Like working at Dell as a reliability engineer, they passed engineering changes, ECs, to me to say, you know, ask whether you think that's going to be a risk or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to tell when they're changing one resistor or resistor supplier.
Right.
You know, a pretty passive component that just you buy in billions. And you know, you just couldn't test for all those things. The constant EC changes on, you know, 12 models of computers or workstations or servers is just, you know, you just can't keep
it's
up
never
with
ending.
It. No, yeah. It's never ending.
But you had that process in place, and enough eyes got a chance to say, "Oh, wait a second." And you did on occasion.
Yeah, occasionally, but. You know, the companies as sizes, HPs and Dells and Acer and all the other companies, you know, have to have, usually they're selling the volumes that they had to have multiple second suppliers.
Or, oh, yeah.
You know, and so they can sometimes, when one supply chain is cut off, they can switch to the other suppliers, but
that are already proven out and stuff. But it doesn't apply to every company and every organization.
And the problem is there, we didn't get to always do mixed builds where we could check all those suppliers on, you know, if we had
on
to change
all the permutations.
Yeah, all the permutations would be, you know, take a hundreds.
You'd
of You'd
be
tests.
There forever, thousands of samples.
Yeah,
you'd be there
exactly.
Forever. Yeah, no, there's something to that, and there's. But the idea is that if you have an established practice in it, that still is relevant. But I think the argument of why do we need to spend the time doing this? We're in an emergency right now is because you know, I always framed it as, all right, what if it increases the failure rate by 5%? It's not unreasonable, right? We have plenty of history of supply chains doing this.
But you'd only know that after the fact.
We only know it after the fact. If we can avoid that by spending $1,000 today or thinking about it a little bit or doing an evaluation, then we avoid $500,000 of costs later. Is that worth it? And I haven't found a single manager or engineer or budget person that says, no, that makes sense. But you have to have those numbers. You have to say, what's the impact of your 5%?
Are going to be 10%.
But it's just a guess at 5%. It's just a guess at 5%. But if it is 5%, it takes some effort to figure out if it's good or not. If it's a 20% increase in failure rate, then I can test two samples. I could tell you that, or 10 samples, and I can tell you that that's a problem or not, right?
Right.
You can look at the change in halt and say, nah, that's going to be a problem. And here's the number.
Somebody tells me we're going to lose 5%, you know, or somebody before they've ever, you know, put it in there. And I say, what is the 5% going to come from? What mechanism is going to be failing?
Yeah.
How do you know that? And tell me, you know, where are you getting those numbers? That's what I want to know.
Now, I had somebody actually do this once. They had a part and they said, but if we'll save this much money if we use this part, and it only cost us this 0.5% change in failure rate for this component. And I'm like, okay, well, it's
0.5%
change in the component's failure rate, which was already really low. All right. So how do you know?
Where did you get that number from?
Where do you get that number? He says, well, we used to use this component. And we swapped it out for one that had a coating on it, so it avoided the corrosion.
Okay.
And our failure rate down, and this is back when they were tracking down to the component level, it went down 0.5%. And so they're going out of business. I can't find another coated one. We want to use this old one we had. And I know the number now. So I says, well, how many of these things do we make? Blah, blah, blah. All right. How much does it cost when one of them failed? Blah, blah, blah. All right. Let's go get a machine that coats these for us because it would be cost effective to do it. It's like, even though it sounds like a really small number, when you multiply it by a million units you're shipping per month, and it costs, you know, it's not like you're replacing just that component when it fails, you're replacing the whole system. It adds up really quick, and you got to have those numbers handy so you can assess whether that's a real change or not. And everything looked great. It says, we used to use this part. We changed to this to fix this issue. It made a minor change in the overall failure rate, blah, blah, blah. And but it was minor to that component. And I was like, you know, when a component fails, it only costs 10 cents to put a new one in.
Yeah.
But it doesn't cost the customer 10 cents to ship it back to us and be without the unit for 2 weeks.
No, I mean, you know, we got the classic case of my, you know, the fact that the aluminum electrolytic capacitor in the Dell and many companies, it's happened before where it
the formula electrolyte was wrong. Formula?
Right. Yeah, but as I've talked about before, and one motherboard, there were 26 of those used, but there were only three or five that were critical, and it would cause the machine, the board not to be able to boot. But when you replace those, even though the other ones were kind of bulging at the top and, you know, obviously failing, it didn't affect function of the computer. And so they had to replace.
Until they vented, I would replace them because once they vent, then you got this gross acid all over the inside of your board. And you know it only goes to the worst possible place.
That might be an after effect that, you know, could affect them or not. But I ran them hours like that, you know, when we replaced the ones that only, you know, were critical and then put the rest of the boards in a 95C environment, just static, but running. Operating boards.
Yeah, I hope you had safety glasses on.
Well, no, they were in the chamber, so we didn't worry about that. But and we had to put a cooling hood over the CPU to keep the over temperature protection from tripping.
Yeah,
and they bulged in about, you know, an hour, the ones that were defective. But again,
it didn't matter.
Didn't matter because, you know, and I asked an engineer, why did you? You know, why are all these capacitors here that really, if they fail, they don't affect the... He says, oh, you know, engineers kind of put them in as a safety margin just to, you know, transients and things like that they might have, filtering capacitors.
Take those units and do the RFI emissions again and you probably won't make it.
Maybe not. So, yeah, I don't know if they, you know, that's included in the FCC testing that they would have to add capacitors, which they may have to do, but that's expensive, especially after you've designed it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's why they put them in at the start. And then,
because
the next program will have more time. We'll do cost reduction. We'll take off half of these capacitors. Yeah.
And that's another aspect that people talk about with this, you know, margin thing. When I first told an engineering manager at Dell, well, we've got, you know, motherboards can run to 135C if we suppress the CPU trip. And he goes, well, we don't need them to run to, is there some way we can reduce the cost and have less margin? You know, can we buy back some of that margin and, you know, make
profit? Only very carefully. It's like, no, not really.
Not really, you know. This is kind of intrinsic to the semiconductor, to electronic component and, you know, FR4 build.
PCBA. If you build it right, it'll work there. It'll be just fine. But if you don't build it well, then you're screwed.
Right. And you've got some really significant margins. I mean, none of these motherboards that I put into the chambers and test for the first time to the limits, they would, you know, run some of them run 110, 100, and no, nobody had ever done that before, so they didn't know.
That went to 42 degrees and it failed. Just total failure. Something burned out. And it goes, well, we only allowed to use the 40C. Yeah, you know, that's so it. That's
our
all
specs
rated
35.
For.
So
35.
Hey,
if you take it outdoors
on a 98 degree day, you're just screwed.
Yeah. No, it's your fault. You know,
it's your fault.
No,
you abused it.
This should have never failed there. This is actually a pretty bad design and or component. So let's figure out which. And then, you know, they did a few simple changes early in this program. They put it back in the chamber. It was up there at 120, 130.
Right.
And just humming away just fine. And they're like, wow.
Yeah, I've seen one resistor change and, you know, or a diode change. It makes a 30-degree difference in its margin. And you know, if they hadn't gone to the limits, they would have known this. Also, they would know, you know, that they have a huge distribution between three different samples or deviation in the limits. And
you got 20% of your products are going to fail at 35, you know.
Yeah, all right.
But anyway, the idea is that we're going to be facing changes, right? And there's lots of pressures on organizations to do cost reduction. And in geopolitical turmoil, that becomes even more apparent. But it happens all the time. Just normally, companies stop a production line on this system, or this component gets changed, and we didn't know that would affect you.
Right.
And all kinds of cool stuff is always going on. So all of those, the individual weekly changes are just practice for when we really got to focus on making serious changes.
Right. You've got changes in production location sometimes, or a contract manufacturer, or, you know, there's just all those changes that you have to be aware of. And that's why I say an empirical test, a limit test, is at least one way. It doesn't catch everything. I mean, no one test catches everything. So, you know,
but it gives you a baseline to evaluate changes. Really
What's
fast.
That?
It gives you a baseline to evaluate a change. If we have to go with a completely different power supply, for example, you put it in and you need two samples and you're off and running, you can tell if it's going to be a disaster or not.
Right.
But it's not going to give you the 0.05% change in failure rate kind of number. It's not going to tell you that, but it'll give you a red flag if it's a disaster.
Right. You can see if it's if the deviation in like 3 to 5 samples is huge, then you know that you're going to have, when you produce 1,000 or 10,000, you're going to have some tails of the weakest one of those, you know, that deviation come into a worst case or even a mild case of stress in the end user's use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the whole point is
right.
You know, the temptation is to take a risk now. Yeah. For future, miss that bullet, you know, kind of thing.
Well, it is.
Hoping.
And when there's a lot of pressure
and
on
sometimes
an organization,
you get it right.
Sometimes you get it right and it's a guess and you just go with it.
And you get lucky.
You get lucky, but it's much better to have the evidence and the data, whether you're thinking it through or analytically or you do it empirically. You have to be prepared that there are going to be changes. Next month's going to be a different set of changes, guaranteed.
Right.
And so get that kind of system in place and the mindset of just because it's an emergency doesn't mean we have to do it like that. Here's the bigger picture. Here's the numbers. Here's the effects and the risks that we're taking. Look at the big picture, do good work in the labs and the design teams and get plenty of margin. You're going to be way more resilient overall. So the best time to respond to the closing of some supply route is design it with lots of margin.
That's exactly it. Design with margin has more tolerance for variation in the components generally and the end use environment stresses. So, you know, margin equals reliability. It's proportional to reliability is my view. And
you're gonna have to make a t-shirt out of that.
And if you can if you can build it to the standard, to the level of, you know, limits of current technology, which also change over time, that you can make sure, you know, you're going to always have a robust product at the lowest cost. So that's what the whole point of reliability is, have a robust product at a very cost-effective price.
Yeah. So for, you know, this note I got, and for others that are facing it at the moment, and it's little solace if you don't have a good program in there and a robust product. So that learn from it, help your organization learn from it and prepare for the next shock to our systems, because it's going to happen. We've had so many in the last 10 years. It's unbelievable. And so it's something to think about. Get ready to go. And if you got questions about that, if you have ideas of how you and your organization are dealing with all these changes and uncertainty, you know, or if you've got some ideas or suggestions, maybe we missed a couple of ideas. Kirk and I tend to talk about electronics more than most anything. But if you're mechanical or software or whatever, we got some ideas on it, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a couple of ways to get in touch. Kirk and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our About pages. So plenty of ways to get in touch, and we look forward to hearing from you.
That's right. We love those questions, and hopefully we hit on a topic that you're really had to deal with or going to have to deal with in the future.
Yeah. Oh, that gives me an idea for another episode. You got some time to record another one, Kirk?
Sure.
All right, here we go. Thanks much, Kirk. We'll talk to you
soon. All right, Fred. Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.